This is Brittany Blackwell, host of the Resilient Teacher Podcast, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, along with this podcast. Each show on the network is independently owned, and the views expressed may not represent those of other podcasts. For the best education podcasts, visit edupodcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back. Steve here, and today I'm talking with Martin Nelson. Martin is a history teacher, writing coach, soccer coach. He speaks multiple languages, loves video games, and the author of the fantasy novel Children of the Dying Hearth. Oh, adventure abounds. It's exciting. The book is fun to read. You're going to love this story, and what's really cool is that you're going to find out that he's got more books coming. So, good stuff. Thanks for listening. Oh, by the way, before you go, it'd be so cool if you helped out the podcast, and I got a couple ways that you could do just that. One would be tell a friend or share the links with someone about the podcast. You know, that'd be so cool. Another way would be to go to my website and leave a review and subscribe. Yeah, that would be nice. And how about click on the link on my website homepage to buy me a coffee? You'll see it right there on the front page. By this, you could donate a dollar or two to help me address the cost associated with producing the podcast. That would be so cool. Thanks so much. You are awesome. Enjoy the show.
They actually have opposing comfort zones. And in that sense, I'm really hoping that the book then kind of speaks to people in a way of you can be each of these characters. You're not tied to one or the other. As I wrote this, it was very much, I have been all these characters at some point in my life where you want to get out from under your parents, or you want to go off and find your own family, or you really know one aspect, but you're just totally ignorant about another. And you know that going out there and getting out where it's cold and dark and scary is the thing that you really need for personal growth.
It's the Education Podcast, your favorite show, with lots of groovy guests and they share what they know. So crank it up to 10 and let your neighbors know that here's another show with Dr. Steve Mileto. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. With Dr. Steve Mileto.
Martin Nelson has served as a high school history and Latin teacher for the past 5 years at St. Mary's School of Medford. Prior to that, he held various positions, including substitute teacher and summer school administrator of modern-day high school in Santa Ana, teaching assistant and writing coach at Fordham University, and a blog editor for the history department at Fordham. Nelson was awarded honorable mention for the L. Ron Hubbard Writers of the Future contest in the Journal of Dr. Rudy J. Gleeman. Martin earned his B.A. in history from University of Portland in Oregon. He received a master's in history from Fordham University in New York. His research interests include early and high medieval Danish political culture, conceptualizations of sanctity, and cultural memory. He speaks three foreign languages, Spanish, Italian, and Latin, and is a member of several professional academic organizations, including American Historical Academy, American Classical League, and Hagiographical Society. True to enjoying anything fantasy, the subject of his debut novel, Children of the Dying Hearth, Nelson spends hours playing video games. He grew up on RPGs like Final Fantasy and Suikoden. He likes getting into a new anime or role-playing a tabletop game. Nelson presently coaches the all-girls soccer team at Catholic High School. A lifetime soccer player, he recently took up Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He also enjoys hunting and fishing. Born and raised in Oregon, he spent time playing semi-professional soccer in Romania, Spain, Portugal, and Germany. He's also lived in California and New York. He can be found on Facebook, Instagram, and on X. And I'll put his links in my show notes so that it's easy for you to find him. But he also has a website, and it's martinraynelson.com. And I'll have all that information in my show notes at the end. He resides with his family in Medford, Oregon. Our focus today is Martin's novel, Children of the Dying Hearth. Martin, welcome to the show, and say hi to everyone.
Hello, everyone. And Steve, thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm so glad to have you here, and our focus today is your book, Children of the Dying Hearth, but before we talk about your book, let's talk about you as a teacher. Why'd you pursue history as a field to teach, and what do you like best about teaching?
Well, I sort of stumbled into teaching backwards. I started teaching really through soccer. I got done playing several years ago, it was about 10 years ago now, and when I got back stateside, from Germany, I had a contact at Modern Day High School as the head girls soccer coach down there. Knew some people that I was involved with at the time, and basically they set me up with a coaching job. And I thought I'm finished up playing, so might as well start coaching while I figure out what to do with my life, what to do with myself, since I've been playing soccer since I was three. And it was through coaching that I really kind of fell in love with the concept itself of teaching and the moments where the kids have that aha moment. With coaching especially, it's really easy and fun to see where you work on something for either the practice or the week or whatever time frame it is, and then you see the big game and they put it all together, and whether it's the passing formation or the specific play that we run, whatever it is, seeing them execute it in the game and then them getting excited like, hey, we did it. That sort of feeling of instilling whatever knowledge I may have into someone else, it really inspired me. In terms of history, that also kind of fell backwards into, because originally during my undergrad years at University of Portland, I was interested in several different social studies and social sciences, mainly psychology, sociology, and anthropology, which I haven't really taken those out of my history studies. It's more just I found out one weekend when I ended up staying in and watching Lord of the Rings for the umpteenth time, and then binging on the internet just hours and hours of myth and history that Tolkien had wrote and where he was inspired, and realizing, you know, I've actually always liked this. And so I started taking a couple history courses, and luckily Portland actually had just hired a medievalist at the time. So he was a fantastic introduction to that sort of realm. And from there, I just kind of fell in love with the actual historical study of the Middle Ages. And taking that professionally, I never would have thought if you'd asked me in high school, which just kind of shows how far we come as individuals.
It is funny the way that works out sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's cool. So you played soccer semi-professionally, professionally, and speak several languages. I mean, so you're all over these other countries and you're playing different people and you speak different languages and such. What impact did the languages and playing soccer have on your writing?
Quite a bit, because there's a few made-up languages in my book, Children of the Dying Hearth, which I'm excited as I move past this first book into the rest of the series. It is a six-part series. The second book is being edited right now, and the third one's about halfway through the manuscript. But the language creation itself I found really invigorating, because it allows you to get into the kind of deep cultural mindset of the people that you're writing about. So understanding how they would construct a sentence really influences how you view the world. I mean, you look at different languages and where they put the verb. So Latin, for instance, generally the verb comes at the end. However, poetry is a little different and they can put it wherever they want because all Latin grammar comes down to word endings for the most part. So having that different linguistic background really helps, one, with the grammatical creation of these different languages that I made for Children of the Dying Hearth. But overall, the real joy of it isn't necessarily coming up with different case endings or anything like that. It's understanding what would be kind of like a pivotal, almost cultural memory or idiomatic construction that these people would have that would be based on a deep history tied to a certain landscape or tied to a certain element of the world, whether they live on the coast or in the mountains or things like that. They would have different words and different, I mentioned idioms before, but different ideas concerning just how they see the world. And you see this in languages that are real. And so why wouldn't you see that in the languages that I'm making up was something that I really wanted to try and convey as much as possible. So towards the end of the book, there is a little exchange in one of these languages, Dolaithi, which it was really fun to write, and it was really fun to construct and everything, which I would love if people try to deconstruct it and figure out exactly what's being said. But for all that, they may need to wait for book two and three for a little bit more of that.
Very cool. That's awesome. That's there's a a music group a bunch of years ago who kind of hit the, they were called Enya. And, and I never forget some of their songs, and I have lots of their music still that I like, because it's nice mood music for when I'm writing or working on something. Yeah. And I remember people were constantly going, well, this doesn't make any sense. So what language is this? And then they used variations of some different languages and such. It's cool that you're the way you're structuring, using your experience and such to structure languages like that. And by the way, you just totally blew out of the water a question I was going to ask you later, which is, so we'll still get there, but when's the next one coming, and how big the series is going to be? So cool stuff. So, so let's take a minute right now to share a brief synopsis of Children of the Dying Hearth.
Yeah, so the book is a multi-perspective high fantasy. And for all those words, usually the easiest comparison I can make, not just because it's popular, but because it's a similar format, is Game of Thrones. There's several different characters that are narrators in the book. And they, my goal with these characters was to have them be very different, at least on the surface. And in the past, this has been somewhat of a struggle for me to figure out, how do I summarize, you know, six different character plots in a 200-word pitch or a 60-second pitch, whatever it is. But as different as they are on the outside, the heart of each character is that they have some sort of childlike aspect of wanting to stay where they're comfortable. And it's something that I think everybody has, that you know what you know, and our comfort zone can often be the death of our futures, or our potential. And some of these characters sort of recognize it. Some it's more of a subconscious movement towards getting out of that comfort zone. But for the most part, every single character here is in that comfort zone, and they recognize to a degree that they need to get out of it. And because of the difference of the characters, those comfort zones or discomfort zones could be antithetical. So I'll pick two examples. One is Faye, who's a half-elf, half-human seamstress who lives in the Crux. That's the major city in the world that kind of unites the four continents. And she's very much under the wing of her mom, who more or less rules her life. And this isn't anything abusive or anything like that. It's just her comfort zone is being at home with her mom that tells her what to do. And she recognizes that she wants to get out of that. She wants something of her own. She wants to have her own business, her own dreams, all that. Whereas contrasting her is C-Rat, who's a young pirate who joins a pirate ship because he's always wanted to go out and sail the seas and be a pirate with these guys. He's somewhat mythologized. And he's left his family, so he's the opposite of Faye in that sense. And he's actually looking for the camaraderie and kind of family aspects that might come with joining a pirate ship. And so these two characters, even though they're similar stages of life, of being in their teens, they actually have opposing comfort zones. And in that sense, I'm really hoping that the book then kind of speaks to people in a way of, you can be each of these characters. You're not tied to one or the other. As I wrote this, it was very much, I have been all these characters at some point in my life, where you want to get out from under your parents, or you want to go off and find your own family, or you really know one aspect, but you're just totally ignorant about another. And you know that going out there and getting out where it's cold and dark and scary is the thing that you really need for personal growth, which, to tie it back to that initial question, that is the heart of the book, which is why, part of the reason why it's named Children of the Dying Hearth. The title itself is somewhat referenced in the book for a different reason, but I love the imagery of someone at their hearth, their fire, their comfort zone, and everything's crumbling around them, and they don't quite recognize it just yet, but they know something's off, and they know they're going to have to leave at some point. And so each of these six characters, they recognize that in themselves to some degree, and they say, it's scary out there, but that's what needs to happen. Here I go.
Love it, love it. So tell me who your target audience is. I've read some things where you've talked a little bit about this, and I think it's pretty cool, and I just want to make sure that I get you a chance to share that.
So if I'm being a salesman, I would say everyone. if I'm being honest, though, I would say this is I classify it as new adult. So it's basically late teen, so end of high school and up. The reason being is because there are some adult elements and adult themes here. There's also that nuance of the comfort zone isn't exactly explicitly stated, right? This isn't kind of a classic hero's journey in that sense. This is much more nuanced of a hero's journey. It's much more internalized, and for some characters at least. For others, it is much more of the classic. You'll recognize the kind of quest characters versus the ones who their quest is much more a personal and emotional one. So for that reason, I like to gear this towards that new adult, late teen, and onwards. Part of it, like I just mentioned, is because there are some adult elements. Kirkus had a funny review that I thought of every time I think of it. It's interesting because they called one scene grotesque, another scene ghoulish. And part of that is because there are scenes of violence in here. It's nothing gratuitous or over the top, that I think at least. It's not just violence for the sake of violence. It is for certain character arcs and character development. And the reason there is that violence is, one, to go back to my background as a historian, with there being pirates in this book, I want to keep them honest to pirates. And if anyone's gone beyond Pirates of the Caribbean and Johnny Depp to look up Edward Teach or Charles Vane, these are brutal guys. These are almost, not always, I don't want to paint that wide of a brush, but they're pretty brutal. They're psychopaths at sea, I like to say. They're in it for themselves. And so to portray that honestly, you need a degree of violence in here. Sometimes implicit, sometimes explicit. But I felt that I needed to have that in order to really do those characters justice and to kind of create, especially amongst Sea Rat and Worf, the two pirate characters, amongst them, the reader's feeling of maybe fear when they deal with the captain or with some of their fellow pirates of, this isn't just singing, drink up me hearty yo-ho and hanging out in taverns and having a good time and everyone's happy. It's the characters are both excited, but they're also deeply afraid of sometimes their comrades. And that's something that is maybe unique to a pirate ship, but at the same time, it's honest to the historicity of these figures that these characters are based on.
I love that. That's because that, and they also have weapons, you know, from cannon to, you know, to swords and battle axes and arrows. I mean, you know, they don't just go, ow.
Yeah. Yeah. The weapons actually for the pirates were kind of fun because all the stuff with the pirates was fun. One of my kind of more favorite smaller characters was a guy named Scythe because he's called Scythe because he used to be a farmer and he carries around a scythe. It's a terrible weapon to have, but it's just this kind of, in his context, a weapon of mass destruction because it's rather indiscriminate about who it hits. And Worf and C-Rat kind of make a note of this as they're near this guy. Like, we don't want to really get too near him because he's hacking off parts, which that part's all implicit violence. There's nothing, like I said, gratuitous about this. This isn't the next entry into the Saw movie franchise.
Gotcha. It is though. What's, you know, really good about this, you know, being able to have those types of thoughts when you do this stuff is that during the historical time eras, I mean, it's not exactly, tag you're it. I don't know. No. You know, they're using them to try and survive the battlefield, whatever that battlefield looks like, whatever, you know, if it's ship to ship or whether it's ship to harbor or whether it's, you know, in an actual, you know, outside of, you know, the battlefield or whatever it is. And I think you do a good job of portraying that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's so the pirates are really fun to write.
That's awesome.
They're all fun to write for different reasons, but I think the pirates have a sort of certain boyish enjoyment about them.
Nice. So one of the things you kind of alluded to just a minute ago is, would you characterize your story as a hero's journey or something else? So let's go in a little more detail there.
Yeah. So I think at the end of the day, yes. But it's not so much the typical hero's journey that people would necessarily think of, right? The quest isn't always external with these characters. For some it is. And I wanted to kind of make that obvious with a couple, because it's fun to play with some fantasy tropes, such as the quest and the kind of promised heir and all that sort of thing. Because I think that's almost a just like the hero's quest is almost a universal concept where people want to look for a savior type figure to help them out of whatever muck they're in. But at the same time, I really wanted to include the human element of what would that mean for the people that are living that. So the hero's quest isn't exactly go out and slay the dragon, but go out and slay the dragon within yourself, which in this first book is very much a internal dragon. There's a quote I heard over a year ago, and it just stuck with me so well, that the devil is doubt. And it's the concept that the two little figures on your shoulder, one being God, one being the devil, the devil is always the one saying, don't do it. Don't go off and try that thing you've always wanted. Don't ask her out. Don't go to the gym. Don't ask for the raise. You know, it's the doubtful voice in your head. And that really is, historically, the dragon and the devil are synonymous. So that's why I'm making that relation just real quick. But for Children of the Dying Hearth, that then dragon that they're off to slay is that internal doubt of, do I have what it takes? And this is one of my somewhat frustrations with some modern fantasy, is I feel like this is a little too easily tied up or brought about through the external quests. Whereas that internal dialogue of doubt, Tessitore is one of my favorites to really point to this one, because he's a former servant, essentially. He's a teenager. These are the three characters I've mentioned so far, are just teenagers. The other three are not, I'll say that. this isn't just for teens. But Tessitore is a teenager who's always been as a servant, and he basically gets told early on, like, hey, you might be the surviving heir to this old lost empire, and people have been searching for you for thousands of years. And the level of psychological gymnastics one would have to do to kind of disregard their upbringing as a servant and suddenly say, yeah, I'm this confident person, is not very believable to me. And so his struggle, as much as it is the kind of classic quest of going to seek out these monks that can tell him, is he the one, sort of thing, is what would that even mean for me? And so he constantly has this doubt within himself of his interactions between people, his interactions at one point with a girl he likes, and his interactions at the end of, like, what sort of life am I giving up? Do I really even want to go back to that sort of life? What am I kind of to do with myself now that I actually have a choice, especially since I've been a servant for so long? And so the deep-seated doubt that he would have is more or less his hero's journey. I do want to make a caveat to the idea of the hero's journey as well, because the six characters, they are not all necessarily heroes. And so part of my love for writing the book and the series is exploring the nature of the human condition. And so it's not just the hero's journey, but the villain's journey as well. And I think that is equally interesting, if not more so, because I think seeing how someone kind of falls from grace in that sort of way is almost a more fascinating story than how someone rises to the occasion, especially since we have countless stories of people rising up to the occasion and solving the problems of their world in fantasy. And I think this is one of the reasons that people are starting to gravitate towards more villainous focused movies and media, such as the popularity of the movie The Joker or Thanos and the Marvel comics. It's the idea of, why are they like this? What made them like this? And so having that that sympathetic villain, I think, is really intriguing. And so writing that perspective is really, really fun. And it's also, it's a nice thought experiment for me to get it onto the page and see what would someone do if they were given the power to really try and fix the world. Would they do it under their kind of their own ambitions? Would they do it under others? What would they do? And so Damian, one of the Pentarchs, one of the five rulers of the Crux, he's one of the main characters. He's in his early 40s, and he's really he's got a bit of a hero's journey, but it's kind of on the knife's edge of, is he a hero or a villain? Because he has the naivete of any new politician of, I can fix the world. And it's, I think history has shown that whenever someone has that mindset, you got to kind of be aware what that might mean.
Nice. I definitely agree with you. I think it's awesome. All right, before we go any further, I got to ask you a couple writing thoughts here. One of the things that's big of people who are thinking about writing something, they have this great idea, is there are people out there who talk about outlining or not outlining. So which one are you? Do you pantser or
both? So I mean, it's a 6-part series, so I have to outline something, right? I have to have some cohesive thread throughout all 6 books. Otherwise, it's going to be a mangled hodgepodge of where the heck that come from? Who are these people? Why'd that happen? Which is actually one of the reasons that I waited so long to publish this one. I sat on this book for about 8 years before I finally published it. And the reason being is I wanted to get through a rough draft of the second book. Because I wanted to make sure I didn't think, man, that would have been nice to include in the first book. Now it just seems random. So outlining to a degree is really helpful if you're trying to go through a fairly complicated story and plot. At the same time, I think if you do it too detailed, it can kill a bit of the fun. And there's a number of chapters in this book where I had more or less the outline of the chapter in a sentence or two, and just say, this is what I need to have happen this chapter. And then kind of just the muses descended, and I thought, man, this would be a really neat idea. And I just crank out a couple thousand words and figure out, this is where I want it to go. And it might alter something a little bit later on or before that I need to then edit, but it keeps the creativity more invigorating, I would say. It really makes it more exciting to write if you don't know every single plot point, if you kind of write it as you go in that sense, but the peaks and the valleys of every plot point are there. Just how am I going to get there? And then you kind of figure it out along the way. So that's my approach to it.
I love it. That's awesome. That's very cool that it's kind of a combination of things too. And that's so cool. One of the things I got to make sure I ask is that your novel required you to build this world that you've referenced. And, you know, one of the things I've seen you discuss a little bit is it's kind of like around the fall of Rome type, but it would fit well in that time era. Could you take a second to talk about how what sort of things, I mean, because earlier you talked a little bit about language and kind of the thought about who the people are. Tell me what stuff you had to do that makes it fit, it seems like it kind of makes it fit well around the fall of Rome.
So part of that, it's all inspired by my undergraduate degree, which was in late antiquity. So roughly the years 200 to 800 during the decline of the Roman Empire. Ways to write that was mainly inspired, It was a partial word choice. So for instance, one example is where the Pentarchs are, actually the Pentarchs themselves. It's based off the Tetrarchy, the four rulers of Rome during Constantine's era, that basically the empire was too big, so they split it into the rule of four. That's more or less an idea stolen in a way from that and then adapted to how would it actually function in this city, in this made up world. And so the term itself is somewhat stolen. but the other words, such as like the Pental Basilica, which is where they reside. A basilica is a classic Roman architectural feature, a meeting place for business and government. And then the word changed over time to basically just mean a church. But the imagery I was really going for throughout any descriptions of the crux was that decline of the Roman Empire, and the decline of Rome. So the structures that are portrayed in the book have this awe-inspiring quality, which I think anyone who's ever been to Rome or a Roman settlement, whether that's in Tunisia or York, right, as they spanned all of Europe, you have to marvel at some of their architectural feats. Seeing the Colosseum up close, like, this was made how long ago? And so several of the characters, as they go through the crux and pass through different archways or bridges, that sort of thing, see the Pental Basilica, there's this awe-inspiring feeling that they get. But at the same time, there's nothing new happening, which I wanted to make that a strict point of the book and of the series, that there's the knowledge of this has more or less been lost. I mentioned Tessitore, one of the main characters, before, and the empire that he may or may not descend from is the ones that originally had this knowledge and built this up and created it, which that then is heavily drawn on Roman history in terms of the history of the city of Rome, because during the Middle Ages, Rome became somewhat of a ghost town. I like to describe it to some of my students as the Walmart of marble during the Middle Ages, because when different European kings wanted to build up their palaces, they just go to Rome and loot the Forum. You have all the structures there, so might as well just take them. But the people around Rome, they don't necessarily have the capability to service all the aqueducts or the sewers or the bureaucracy that it takes to run a city of a million people. So they sort of abandon it, which is also why then you get Renaissance paintings of Rome covered in moss and ivy and all these basic nature, just because it's been run down.
Gotcha. It's really cool because it obviously plays a nice background for you to help develop your world around and such, and just the different events that were going on from, you know, outside forces coming into the realm and forcing changes there, as well as, you know, the establishment of the bound, you know, what they had to create boundaries and such and deal with. I mean, I can only, this is awesome to think about as you're trying to create your world and using a kind of a time frame to help you establish it, I guess, is my point. I love that. One of the things that talked about a little bit is you mentioned a few of your characters and stuff like this, and you mentioned a couple of the types of peoples. I mean, and so when we talk about, character development, you have these different peoples in your story. And so how'd you kind of design these different people that you're going to create? I mean, you know, I'm a former player of D&D and some other things like that, and I've read a lot of fantasy books, and I'm always curious about how, you know, what you choose to include and not include and how you go about making them a separate people.
Yeah. So I think the tropes are always fun to draw on. So there's dwarves and elves and men, right? Those are the classic kind of Tolkien-esque peoples. There's another group that I've introduced as well called the Erdi, that make an appearance in this first book, that will be more prominent later on. But I think the peoples themselves are almost necessary for fantasy, because it makes it more fantastical. It makes it much more like this isn't your world. And so it's a soft slap in the reader's face in a good way of saying, like, this isn't Atlanta. This isn't New York. This is somewhere else. So nice. You can introduce the start of a story. Just say, like, Kel the elf was walking through the forest. And it's like, oh, this is completely different world. I already know that right off the bat. At the same time, I think the fun thing for me is, again, playing with that trope, because the idea of elves is pretty hashed out in a lot of different fantasies. For me, designing essentially all three of those races as a wholly contained culture was really fun, because it's this is maybe going to sound narcissistic, but you get to play God. You get to say, like, all right, if there's a group of people who base their whole worldview off this aspect of life, what would that actually evolve into? And you get to kind of play with their worldview. So the elves are fairly sequestered off in their continent, and they have some distrust of dwarves, but this is actually one of the funny things I was discussing with someone recently as well, that there's in fantasy, there's a bit of implied racism that isn't always seen, because it's usually between dwarves and elves. And since no one in the real world is a dwarf or an elf or that right. sort of thing, we don't always see it. But there's this distrust of the other, of the people that are not us. And so it's fun to kind of take the mask off of characters and get down to the human element of who are these people at their core. And whether they're elves or dwarves or men, I think everyone can see a little bit of themselves in them, because every race, regardless of what fantasy book you're reading, always has the idea of, like, this is what I know based on my cosmological background, my religious background, my whole worldview. And I think it's the best because that's what I was raised with. That's what I know. And the other side believes the same thing. And I think the joy of fantasy then is, like I said, you can kind of take the mask off the person and get to the kind of the human soul underneath, even though I'm talking about elves and dwarves, because I could write the same sort of story regarding tensions between Puerto Rican and Cuban immigrants in Florida. And that will likely strike more with Puerto Ricans and Cubans in Florida than it will with someone from the Blackfoot tribe, right, in the Dakota Hills or something. The identity of the individual is then secondary to the actual story, which is the human underneath and their idea that this is the culture that I was raised with, and I believe it's right because that's what my people are. And so that to me was a lot of fun to write and a lot of fun just to create, because there's a lot of stuff in that's not in the book that I basically had to hash out beforehand. Just as a quick aside with that as well, with the second book, Thena, who's one of the Pentarch, she's a female dwarf. She's one of the narrators in the second book, and there's a letter that she has, and it alludes to a long poem that I wrote, basically, that's all about the cosmology of the dwarves, that I go back and forth. My wife says, you should include that in, like, some sort of appendices at the back of the book. And at the same time, it's enjoyable just to kind of tease these things and say, there's so much more here that I have that I don't want you to know all of it, but it's like, here's kind of the teasers of it. So the names and the places and kind of the different things that come up in that letter that she reads. It was fun because I had to create this whole underlying structure just to have a letter that she wrote.
I love that. That's awesome. And by the way, it also lends itself to, if you ever wanted to have some extra little things out there about your book, you could have the map made, you could have the poem, special edition with the poem and so forth. So
Well, I have maps in the back of the book already, and it's that those were fun to create. They're a little frustrating at times getting the how exactly to do that, but I'd had the map roughly sketched for years now, but actually nice. Getting that to where it didn't look like a two-year-old had drawn it on a napkin was the fun part.
I like that. That's but I think that's all part of the creating the world, is that if you actually go about making things artifacts that show that it exists. And that's awesome. I love it. You know, Martin, we're starting to finish up. If someone wanted to follow up and connect with you and or learn more, where would you send them?
So my website, martinraynelson.com, has all my writing available for the most part. There's some things like that poem that's not up there. But the all the links to the book are up there. The hard copy is up on Amazon. The ebook is up on every major online retailer, so Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Apple Books, all those. But my website, Martin Ray Nelson, will have those. It also has my academic writing on there. If anyone's curious about St. Perpetua or Duke Knut Lavarth in the 12th century, there's a lot more there than just the book. It's like we were talking before, it's a rather varied background. There's also, it's up for free, my short story that you mentioned at the start, the Journal of Dr. Rudy J. Gleeman, which I got that honorable mention in the L. Ron Hubbard Writers of the Future contest. That's up there for free. So if anyone wants to read that, that was a fun story I wrote after I just binged Lovecraft one summer. And I just had this kind of thought experiment of like, what would happen if this? And so I originally planned that for a full length thing. And then it ended up being a short story because I heard about the contest. So I was like, I'll kind of truncate this down and submit it and see what happens, and got an honorable mention, which felt good. Yeah, martinraynelson.com would probably be the best way to find any of my writings or to reach out to me personally.
Awesome. And I'll have that information in the show notes, so it's easy to click on and go right to you, which is really cool. I got a last question I want to ask you, and I think it's kind of cool because you're a teacher. But do you have a teacher in your past who made a difference in your life? If so, who was it, and what would you say if given the chance to say thank you?
Well, having gone through school all the way through the master's, there's a number of teachers I've come across. It's kind of funny because I work at the high school that I went to now. They basically said, if you take over the Latin program, you can teach any history course you want. Wow. And so I get to say thank you to a lot of the influences on my life there already. But for going outside of that, I would say Dr. Bradley Franco at University of Portland was really influential to me, just because he was sort of the advisor, mentor that I feel like I really needed during my undergrad years of, I'm interested in the Middle Ages and I don't have anywhere to go. And he was the medievalist that they hired at University of Portland. And I kept going to him for all sorts of things. And then he ended up writing a letter of recommendation that I'm sure helped get me into grad school at Fordham. With that being said, Dr. Nicholas Paul and Dr. Marianne Kowalewski at Fordham are both also influential. And I talk to both of them every now and then. Marianne a little bit more so because my Latin students and I publish every year or two with Fordham University, of published different translations that have never been translated into English before. So they have an internet history source book. So they've been very influential in my life, and they've helped me more than they know.
That's awesome. That is so cool. I got to ask you this. So when's the second, third, fourth?
So, since, like I said, I like to write kind of one book ahead before I really publish anything. The second one's being edited right now. It's on draft. I don't know which one. And the third book is halfway written as a rough draft. So I'm hoping to finish that third one as a rough draft early in the summer. And the second one, by then, I'll have kind of not looked at it for a while. And so I can look at it again with fresh eyes, especially after it's been edited. And so I would really love for the second one to be out by the end of the year. That would be a good kind of anniversary, especially since I published Children of the Dying Hearth a couple years ago at the end of the year. It was a December publishing, so having that for the second one would be really, really nice. That's my, I want to say soft goal, or I want to say hard goal, but it, part of me also knows that life gets in the way. In a good way, though. My wife is actually expecting in a month our firstborn, so life will definitely be getting in the way.
Most definitely. Congratulations on that. That's cool.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Well, that's awesome. So looking forward to the second one coming out and whatever comes after that as well. And wish you the best. Martin, thank you so much for sharing your book, Children of the Dying Hearth. Adventurous, engaging, exciting. I love it. Wishing you the best in all you do.
Thank you, Steve.
Hey, you have been listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast to help you help kids achieve their dreams. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a member of the podcast network based in Canada called Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right here. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Hey, thanks for listening. It would be awesome if you visited my website at stephenmoletto.com and connected with me, left a review, and listened to more episodes. And by the way, you could also share it with your friends, with your family, and your colleagues. Thanks so much. You're awesome.